All too quickly, talkative, affectionate young boys seem to slip away. Adolescents may be transformed overnight into reclusive, seemingly impenetrable young people who open up only to their friends and spend more time on their devices than they do with their own families. So how do we penetrate that shell? How do we penetrate it before they are lost to us? Drawing on decades of experience garnered through thousands of hours of therapy with boys, clinical psychologist Adam Cox's new book, Cracking the Boy Code, explains how the key to communicating with boys is understanding their universal psychological needs and using specific, straightforward communication techniques. Again, the name of the book is Cracking the Boy Code, and we welcome Adam Cox to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
Let's start off of what is the boy code and why does it need to be cracked?
Well, the boy code is essentially a set of strategies that help parents, teachers, and others who want to connect with boys connect at a deeper level, to really know boys beyond just the kind of superficial behavioral issues that typically we associate with boys. One of the reasons that I wrote the book, Joe, was not just to help parents and teachers connect with kids, but also to advocate for boys who, you may be aware, are often described only in terms of their behavioral problems. And so, you know, the often the attitude about boys is, however we can best manage them, that's what we need to focus on. And I'm really making a case, I hope, for knowing and understanding the psychology of boys so that we can connect at a deeper level.
What is it about the boy code that is different than the girl code and that is so unique and perhaps has been overlooked?
This is something that I have learned over the course of 25 years in clinical practice, specializing in treating school-age boys. And I have, I think, probably made every mistake that a person could make in trying to connect with boys. But over the course of 25 years, I've learned some basic differences between genders and how to kind of connect with the psychology of boys. And the biggest thing, the most important thing we can do, is to put tone or form before content. We too often think that the substance of a great conversation with boys is going to be that we have to focus on the right topic. And yet the biggest thing to focus on is the tone of the conversation. And along those lines, in my book, I emphasize the major strategy, which is to use something that I call task tone, to be very matter-of-fact, slightly monotone in the way that you talk to boys. Because when we do that, we are connecting with boys' left hemisphere, which is the side of their brain that they tend to process information on. And it's just easier for them to make sense of what we're saying. It's easier for them to avoid that kind of heightened emotionality, which sometimes gets their defenses up and causes them to feel very vulnerable and apprehensive about talking.
Has this changed dramatically over time, or is this something that goes back to the beginning of time when it comes to young men?
I think that it has gone back for a long, long time. It's interesting that you ask that question, because one of the things that I've learned, and this is, of course, this is a Hollywood film, but was highly informative in my training way back when. I was trying to run social skills groups for boys and having great difficulty getting them to engage and to connect with me. And, you know, lying on the sofa one weekend just watching TV, on came the movie Gladiator with Russell Crowe that I'd never seen before. And there in the opening scene of the movie, there's the character of Maximus trying to rally his troops to go into battle. And he comes up with a credo that galvanizes their focus, their courage, their honor, and it is the credo is strength and honor. And it hit me like a ton of bricks, and I've used that for 15 years in my work with boys to get them to engage in therapy. It's this concept of strength and honor, the strength to do what's right, the honor to do it well. But I take from that movie, of course, depicting life, you know, hundreds of years ago, that this was always a necessity in relating to males, that there was always the need for some type of credo that kind of drew them into relationship and into a sense of mission and focus and purpose. That's the big concept for boys, is purpose. Where there is purpose, there is motivation and there is progress and there is the opposite of inertia. And, you know, in 25 years, families have come to see me. And, of course, what so many families in the age of games, video games, and social media are concerned about is inertia in boys, where they just become sedentary and they are kind of in a spectator screen culture. I've tried to address some of those concerns in my book by emphasizing the important role of purpose in boys' lives.
So let me ask you the nature versus nurture question. So how much is it on the parents? How much is it of it is innate?
I think a ton of it is innate, but why should we focus on the things that we can't do anything about? We should maintain a more positive and constructive focus and just really press on those things that we can make a difference about. And, you know, if anything, my career has shown me that you can always make some degree of difference. And lots of times, you know, I'm coming up against kids who just struggle with social communication. Boys are really good at instrumental communication. They can say, pass the milk. Can I have 20 bucks? Are you going to eat all those fries? But what they can't focus on or do as well is the social communication skills. But we can, even with boys who are very physical, kinesthetic people, boys who learn by moving, by touching, by mapping space in their mind, even those kids can learn some good social communication strategies when it's modeled in a way that doesn't feel emasculating, doesn't feel condescending, and doesn't make them feel like, you know, something's wrong with me.
When you think about those feelings of that there's something wrong with me, I'm not doing what I should do, in your profession, you see that that can manifest itself very early.
Oh my gosh, yes. I mean, you see that, you know, in kids who are in kindergarten and first grade. You know, there is no question that a lot of the behavioral issues, the things that bring families into therapy, those are issues about respect. There is a tremendous need. There are some kids who just the way that they're wired have a very strong need for respect early in life. And sometimes we get frustrated because as parents or teachers, we might think to ourselves, what has this child done to deserve respect? But we can't think of it that way because if we do, we miss a golden opportunity. And as a corollary, for example, we would not walk through, you know, an orphanage full of babies that were crying and say to them, you know, well, as soon as you learn to stop crying, we'll pick you up and we'll cuddle you. Of course, we would reach down, pick the child up, provide comfort, and try to stop the crying that way. It's the same way with boys who are a little bit older. If we're waiting for them to accept the hierarchy of life, that adults are always in charge, that adults are always right, before we give them any respect or acknowledgement, we are missing a huge opportunity to make a difference in the lives of kids. So we should find ways to give respect, and we should create opportunities for kids to do things that earn respect. That's partly what I mean by this very important concept of purposeful work.
I asked the question about when we see it manifest itself, because I think we so often think of it as emerging as an issue during adolescence.
That's right. You know, during adolescence, and the reason for that, Joe, of course, is that it's during adolescence when it seems to be a crisis. Even though the signs are there for younger boys and we should be intervening earlier rather than later, it's by adolescence that we think, okay, now this person has grown physically large. They seem to be able to kind of hold us at arm's length, and it's very difficult for us to redirect sometimes. So it seems to be an issue in it seems to be a bigger crisis in adolescence, but the problem starts much earlier.
When you think about the role of schools, are we doing enough? Should we be doing something different? And how does that all fit into this individual responsibility, parental responsibility, and those of educators?
You know, since I started writing about boys about 15 years ago, I spent much of my time visiting schools and trying to work with schools to develop a culture that is boy-friendly in lots of ways, because lots of boys will say in my office or in the focus groups that I've done with boys around the world that their school is not necessarily boy-friendly, that when they're acting in ways that they consider to be kind of more or less typically boyish, that very often they're met with frowns or a kind of disdain and they get very frustrated. And that is more difficult, say, between the ages of 8 and 11, where kids have, you know, some need to be a little bit more active, have more difficulty with self-control. But I think that, it, you know, with respect to what schools are doing, it's a little uneven. There are some schools that are doing absolutely a fantastic job, and they are even thinking about the architecture of schools so that the design of classrooms, the width of hallways is greater. They're really kind of accommodating the physical nature of so many boys. And then, unfortunately, there are many other schools that it hasn't progressed a lot since, you know, 1950. And so we're still expecting this sense of comportment, which is not really realistic for the way that boys are developing, and which unfortunately leaves them with the sense that, you know, school, very often in school, they feel like fish out of water.
Since we are talking about this so much, and it's part of our national conversation, what is our responsibility when it comes to the boy code in how they deal with the girl code and women.
I think that's absolutely key. And one of the important things that we can do is to help boys to be better listeners. And so one of the things that I've often felt is very important is, you know, as often as I have initiated some type of group conversation among a group of boys where they're kind of digging for, you know, their deeper understanding about important issues in their life and in culture in general, I have also wanted them to be listeners to girls having the same kind of conversation. And so, you know, we have to kind of progress beyond the old paradigm, which is like, okay, let's try to divide up the classroom time equally so that we're hearing from kids of both genders. Of course, that's important, but we need something that reaches beyond that to a deeper level of empathy and a deeper level of understanding. And I think that if you talk to boys and you're having an authentic conversation with them, they are intensely interested in the differences between themselves and girls and how girls think about issues differently than they do and the reasons that girls think about issues differently than they do. I mean, after all, this is a primary point of interest for adolescent boys in particular, is they are very eager to understand the psychology of girls. So I don't know why we don't seize on that opportunity to really make that conversation even broader and more meaningful.
Do you see it just in the last year anecdotally that we are seizing on that opportunity?
In the last year? I can't think that in the last year that we're seizing on that opportunity too much. I think that it's the rare school that is actually doing something that is, you know, a little bit more experimental, a little bit more adventuresome in terms of working with that kind of cross gender understanding. And I hope that even this interview, someone's listening and decides we should try something like that in our school, because it's not that difficult to do. There are other schools that will partner with you, that will provide opportunities for kids to visit different schools. It works best in some ways if kids are not working or listening closely only to those kids that they already know very well, but are maybe venturing to a different community, a different school. But the more we do of that type of work, the better off we'll be.
Because of the national conversation we're having, I guess it surprises me that more is not being done on the school level to work between the intersection and the responsibilities of boys and girls and the respect and understanding of those roles.
So here's what I think is the truth about that situation is that, for example, the Me Too movement. How are we dealing with Me Too within the scope of schools? And I think that largely it's dealt with the same way that the issue of bullying was dealt with. And that means that we have a big school assembly. We have either the head of school or perhaps a guest speaker come in and provide what is hopefully an inspirational and insightful talk about that issue, which is a good thing to do. At least, you know, on the surface, it seems like that's a good start. It's just that it doesn't move kids out of a kind of, you know, again, a spectator position. And I think that we need to make way for kids' voices to be talking about that issue and to be working on it the same way they would be working on understanding a great work of literature or unraveling, you know, the mysteries of math or whatever it might be. There is a tremendous need for a greater, you know, a greater instruction of psychology in schools. Kids as young as fifth or sixth grade are ready to learn about some of these basic psychological ideas, and understanding gender differences would be a key element of that.
The name of the book is Cracking the Boy Code. Adam Cox, thank you very much for spending time with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thanks so much, Joe.
Thank you. Again, the name of the book, Cracking the Boy Code. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.